Welcome back to the Deep Dive. I've got a really interesting one today because it sort of challenges a fundamental assumption most of us have about technology. We tend to think of our electrical grid, our data centers, you know, even our home electronics as these distinct man-made systems, wires, silicon, copper, all that.
Right. We see them as separate from nature. You know, we build the machine and the machine just sits on the world.
Exactly. But today's source material, which is an incredibly detailed guide called Principles and Methods of Earth Resistance Measurement, it forces us to look down at the one component we almost always ignore.
The literal dirt.
The ground beneath our feet.
It has to be the most overlooked component in electrical engineering. I mean, we spend millions on copper cabling and high-tech breakers, but the entire safety of that system, it often boils down to how well it connects with a few cubic meters of mud.
And that's the mission for this deep dive. We are not just reading a manual here. We're trying to unpack the physics of how we connect our electrical world to the actual physical planet. And honestly, reading this, it felt less like a textbook.
And more like a survival guide?
Yes, exactly. A survival guide.
Well, that's not really an exaggeration. The stakes here are incredibly high. This isn't just about, you know, a little audio hum in your speakers.
Right.
If you get earth resistance wrong, grounding systems fail. And when they fail, that fault current, that huge surge of electricity, it has nowhere to go. So you're looking at catastrophic equipment damage, fire, and a very real risk to human life.
Okay, so let's get into it. The source creates this immediate distinction that I think probably trips a lot of people up. It separates the idea of a grounding system into two very different concepts.
It does.
There's the rod you drive into the ground, and then there's the ground itself.
It's that classic hardware versus environment problem. And to get it right, we have to define our terms very strictly. The source differentiates between two things, soil resistivity and earth electrode resistance.
They sound almost the same.
They do, but they are fundamentally different variables.
All right, so let's start with the environment then. Soil resistivity. How does the source actually define that?
You should think of soil resistivity as a property of the material itself. You know, like its density or its hardness. Technically, it's the resistance of a specific unit of earth, usually 1 cubic meter.
So you imagine digging up a perfect 1 meter cube of dirt.
And measuring the resistance from one face to the opposite face? Exactly. That value is your baseline. It's what nature gives you.
And I'm guessing that baseline is all over the map because geology is just messy.
Wildly. It depends entirely on the geological cocktail you're standing on. So clay is totally different from sand, which is different from granite. You can't change it. You can only measure it and then try to work with it.
So how do you measure that cubic meter of dirt without actually, you know, digging it up?
Thankfully, you don't have to. You use what's called a 4-electrode method right in the field. You drive 4 small auxiliary probes into the ground in a straight line, equally spaced.
Okay.
Then you pump a current through the outer 2. You measure the voltage across the inner 2. And then you just apply a formula. It's like taking an electrical x-ray of the soil.
Okay, so that's the canvas. That's the dirt. Now, let's contrast that with the second term, earth electrode resistance.
Mm-hmm.
This is where we actually build something.
Correct. This is the resistance of the connection we create. But here's the real aha moment from the source. Earth electrode resistance is not the resistance of the copper rod.
I think that's the number one misconception. You buy a high quality copper rod, you think, okay, great conductor, low resistance.
Right. But the metal rod itself has negligible resistance. I mean, it's basically 0 compared to the earth.
Hmm.
The actual resistor in this whole circuit is the mass of soil immediately surrounding that rod.
That transition point.
Yes. That's where the resistance happens, as the current tries to push its way out of the rod and into the dirt.
The source used a really interesting visual for this. It talked about shells of earth extending out to infinity.
It's a beautiful bit of physics, isn't it? Imagine the rod is the center of an onion. The first layer of dirt touching the rod has the smallest surface area, so it offers the highest resistance.
Okay.
But as you move outward, the shells of earth get bigger and bigger. More surface area means less resistance.
So mathematically, the further you get from the rod, the easier it is for the electricity to flow.
Exactly. And the source notes that technically, yeah, the calculation extends to infinity. But in practice, the first few meters are doing almost all the work. So if the soil right up against your rod is dry sand, it doesn't really matter if the soil 20 feet away is wet clay. You've already lost the battle at that contact point.
Which brings us to the chemistry of that battle.
Yeah.
We tend to treat dirt as, well, just dirt, inert. But the source treats soil as this dynamic, changing electrical component.
It is. It's electrically alive, and it has three main levers we need to understand. Chemicals, water, and temperature.
Let's start with chemicals. The source mentions salts.
This is huge, because pure water actually isn't a great conductor. It's the ions dissolved in the water that carry the charge.
The salts.
Right, the natural salts in the soil. And the source is clear. Higher salt concentration equals lower resistivity. You want salty earth.
Which explains why grounding near the coast might be easier. But then there's moisture. The general rule seems obvious. Wet dirt is better than dry dirt.
Generally, yes. Moisture is the vehicle for those salts. Dry soil is basically an insulator. You need at least 15-20% moisture to get decent conductivity.
But I caught a counterintuitive detail in the source. It actually warns against excessive moisture. Why would too much water be a bad thing?
It's the washout effect. If you have water constantly flowing through the soil, like if it's completely saturated for a long time, it can literally wash away those beneficial salts. You end up with clean, wet sand, which is surprisingly resistive. You want damp, nutrient-rich soil, not a distilled water bath.
That is a nuance I would have completely missed. You can drown your grounding system. Okay, the third lever is the one that really scares me, especially for facility management. Temperature.
This is the silent killer of grounding systems.
The source had a specific stat on this. For every degree Celsius above zero, conductivity increases by about 2%.
Which sounds great in the summer, but just flip that around. As it gets colder, resistance goes up. And the critical danger zone is the freezing point.
What happens at 0 degrees Celsius?
The water in the soil turns to ice. And ice is a crystal. It locks all those ions in place. So it stops being a conductor and becomes an insulator.
Yeah.
The resistance doesn't just creep up. The source says it skyrockets the moment the ground freezes.
So if you're a safety manager, you certified your ground grid in July, and it was maybe just barely passing.
Then come January, when that frost line is a meter deep, you might as well have no ground at all. Your safety system has just vanished.
That is terrifying. It really drives home that grounding is not set it and forget it.
Not even close. It requires constant vigilance.
Okay, so we know the variables, but sometimes you're just stuck with bad dirt. We can't change the weather. We can't salt the earth forever. So the source pivots to geometry. If the dirt is bad, how do we change the shape of the metal to compensate?
You've got two main moves. Go deeper or go wider?
The source seemed to really favor going deeper.
Well, physics favors deeper. When you drive a rod deeper, you're doing two things. First, you're exposing it to more mass of earth, more of those shells we talked about. But maybe more importantly, you're reaching layers of soil that are more stable.
Moisture, less likely to freeze.
Exactly. Mm. Moisture, richer in minerals, and yeah, most critically, unfrozen. The source also mentioned that a long, thin rod is much better than a short, thick one.
Right. Doubling the diameter only drops resistance by what, 10%?
About that. But doubling the length can drop it by 40%. It's the length that really matters.
Well, but if you hit bedrock 6 feet down, then what?
Then you have to go wide. You use parallel electrodes. So you drive a second rod, connect it to the first, maybe a third.
But the math there was tricky. I wrote this down. Two rods do not give you half the resistance.
Correct. It's the law of diminishing returns. The source states that two parallel electrodes reduce the resistance by about 40%, not 50%.
Gonna have 50%.
It's because of those shells of influence again. If the rods are too close together, their electrical fields overlap. They end up fighting for the same patch of dirt.
So you have to space them out.
You have to. Usually at least the length of the rod apart. If you just hammer two rods right next to each other, you're basically just wasting copper.
Okay, we've built the system. We understand the soil. Now, the part that takes up most of the document, measurement. How do we actually know it works?
This is where the rubber meets the road, or I guess the copy meets the clay.
And before we even touch the meters, the source has this huge, bold section on safety.
Non-negotiables. You are potentially interacting with fault currents. So the source demands you disconnect the main power, use lockout tagout procedures so nobody can flip a switch on you, and PPE is mandatory.
Because if there's a fault somewhere on the grid, that ground rod you're holding could be the exit door for the lightning.
Exactly. You never, ever assume a ground is dead.
Okay, so the measurement itself, the fall of potential method, the source calls it the gold standard. How does it work?
It's just Ohm's law, really. You need three things. Your permanent ground electrode, the one you're testing, then a current probe you drive in the ground some distance away, and a potential probe you place in between them.
The three-pin setup.
Right. You inject a known current from your meter, it goes through the earth to that distant current probe and returns. Then you use that middle probe to measure the voltage drop at various points. Voltage divided by current is resistance.
But it's not just one reading, right? You have to move that middle stick around.
To do it properly, yes. You move the middle probe at, say, 10% of the distance, then 20%, 30%, and so on. You plot these points on a graph, and what you're looking for is a flat section in the curve.
A plateau.
Exactly. Near your first rod, resistance shoots up. Near the distant rod, it shoots up again. But in the middle, if they're spaced correctly, there should be a zone where the resistance barely changes. That plateau, that's the true resistance of the Earth.
That sounds pretty time-consuming.
Yeah.
And you need a lot of space.
It is. And that's why the source introduces the 62% rule. This is probably the most practical takeaway for anyone actually working in the field.
Sounds like a cheat code. Instead of mapping the whole curve, you just jump to the 62% mark.
It's a mathematical shortcut, but it's a rigorous one. It turns out that based on the geometry of those hemispherical shells, the perfect balance point where the influence of the first rod ends and the second begins mathematically falls at roughly 61.8% of the distance.
61.8%. Wait, that's the golden ratio?
It is. The physics of electricity in soil mirrors the geometry of nature. So if you place your probe at 62%, you are, in theory, hitting that plateau immediately.
But the source had a big warning here. Trust, but verify.
Always. You can't just take that one reading and go home. The source recommends an error test. Take a reading at 62%, then another at 52%, and one at 72%. If those three numbers are all about the same,
you're good. You found the plateau.
You're good. But if they vary wildly, you're not on a plateau. You're on a slope. It means your probes are too close, or there's a pipe buried somewhere messing things up. You have to reset and go wider.
Which leads to the messy reality of the job site. The fall of potential method is great in a big open field, but what if you're downtown? Or in a rocky industrial park, you can't just walk 100 feet in a straight line.
And this is where the survival guide aspect really kicks in. The source outlines these advanced methods for when the gold standard just isn't possible.
Okay, what about the slope method? When do you use that?
You use the slope method when you can't find that plateau. Maybe the site is just too small. Your resistance curve is just a constant hill. It never flattens out. The slope method uses some fairly complex math to basically calculate where the plateau would be if you had infinite space.
So it's an extrapolation.
A deeply mathematical one, yes.
And what about physical obstructions? Like, I can't go straight, there's a building in the way.
Then you use the three-point or triangulation method. You don't put the rods in a line, you drive them at different angles to the main electrode.
But there's a rule there, too. The 5D rule.
A crucial rule. Your auxiliary rods have to be at a distance of at least 5 times the greatest dimension of the electrode you're testing.
5 times. Why so far?
To escape its sphere of influence. If you're testing a 10-foot rod, your test probes need to be at least 50 feet away. Any closer, and you aren't measuring the earth anymore, you're measuring the magnetic coupling between the rods. You're just measuring your own test setup.
There was one more method I found really clever. For, like, urban retrofits, the similar grounding connection method.
Ah, yes, the lazy man's method. But sometimes it's the only option you have. Let's say you've got a new transformer on a concrete pad, you can't drive test rods. But nearby, there's a massive water main or an old utility grid that you know has a very low resistance.
So you use that existing grid as your test probe?
Basically, yeah. You measure the loop between your new rod and that old grid. You get a total resistance. Then, and this is the approximation part, you either subtract what you think the old grid's resistance is, or you just divide by 2 and assume they're equal.
Quick and dirty.
It's an approximation. I wouldn't certify a nuclear plant with it, but for a quick check, it's very useful.
The source lists a few others. Dead Earth, Star Delta, the RT method. But the takeaway for me wasn't the specific steps, it was the sheer variety. It really shows there's no one-size-fits-all for this.
That is the key insight. Soil is complex, it's layered, it's wet, it's rocky, it's full of old pipes. You need a whole toolkit of methods because the environment will constantly throw curveballs at you.
So let's zoom out a bit. We've gone from defining a cubic meter of dirt to, what, calculating resistance curves out to infinity. We've learned that salt is good, too much water is bad, and freezing weather is a kill switch for safety.
And we've learned that the most important component of your electrical system is probably the one you didn't buy from a supplier.
So why does this matter to someone who's not an electrical engineer? Maybe they manage a building or just own a home.
It matters because we all have this false sense of permanence. We build a house, we install the grounding rod, we check the box, done. But the source proves that grounding is dynamic.
It's a living system.
It is. If you installed a rod 10 years ago during a wet spring, and now you're in the middle of a drought, or it's a record-breaking freeze, that system might not work today. If you manage a facility, you can't rely on a test from 5 years ago. You have to realize the performance of your safety gear changes with the seasons.
And if you ignore the earth part of earthing, you're compromising the only thing that stops a power surge from frying your servers or hurting your staff. I want to leave the listener with a thought that really stuck with me from that whole infinity section.
Go for it.
When we measure earth resistance, we are technically measuring the interaction of our little rod with the soil extending out to infinity. And that sort of implies there's no such thing as an isolated system.
We're all sharing the same return path.
Exactly. My toaster, the substation down the street, the massive data center hosting this conversation, we are all physically, chemically connected through the crust of the planet. We treat technology like it separates us from nature, but in the world of high-voltage safety, nature is an active, non-negotiable part of the machine.
We're just borrowing the dirt to complete the circuit.
A grounding thought, literally. Thanks for listening to this deep dive. Check your connections, respect the soil, and we'll see you next time.